Greetings, everyone. My name is Patrick Brown, and you're listening to Crown and Crozier, the podcast on church, state, and faithful citizenship. We have got an extra special guest for you this episode. Depending on who you ask, he's something of a rare specimen, an endangered species, or perhaps even a white martyr. Dan Lipinski represented the 3rd Congressional District of Illinois in the U.S. House of Representatives from 2005 to 2021. Among his claims to fame is maintaining both his Democratic Party affiliation and a staunchly pro-life voting record, even in the midst of his party leadership adopting extremely permissive and arguably militant policy positions in favor of abortion. This courage and steadfastness played a huge role in the party establishment and activists mobilizing to defeat him in the Democratic primary for his House seat in early 2020, and thus close the curtain on his service in elected office. In this episode, we talk with Congressman Lipinski about what it's like being last pro-life man standing in a political party, the role of faith in public life, the state of U.S. politics in the 2024 election campaign, evangelizing the culture and restoring its capacity to love, and what insights Pope Leo XIII may have for us in the current political moment. The congressman is one of those rare public officials with the letters PhD after his name, holding a degree in political science. He serves as Distinguished Visiting Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University and Pope Leo XIII Fellow on Social Thought at the University of Dallas. In addition, he's the president of his own consulting firm, Lipinski Solutions. Thanks so much, as always, for tuning in, and enjoy the conversation.
There are two swords. And the question is, which sword is superior, the spiritual sword or the temporal sword?
And without God, democracy will not and cannot long endure.
I die His Majesty's good servant, but God's first.
It's a great honor to welcome our guest for this installment of Crown and Crozier, Congressman Dan Lipinski. Congressman, thanks so much for joining us.
It's very good to be with you.
This is kind of a unique moment in time when we're having this conversation. We're recording very early in the first week of March. Super Tuesday in the primary cycle falls tomorrow. And then later this week, we have a State of the Union address by President Biden. So hoping we can start our conversation there with those two key moments in the near-term calendar. So with Super Tuesday approaching, all signs point towards President Biden securing the nomination on the Democratic side and former President Trump securing the nomination for the Republican ticket. Just in terms of where we are in the campaign cycle, everything that's unfolded up until now, and what lies ahead, what do you make of things? What's your take on things, and where's your head and your heart at?
Well, I'm with the 70 to 75% of Americans who say that they're not happy with the Biden-Trump rematch. So I think it's not good for the country. I do not expect to be supporting President Biden. I expect to be supporting, and I wish this were actually recorded a couple of weeks later. By the time this comes out, I'm hoping that the No Labels organization has put forth a president, vice president ticket. They have said that they want to put a Republican in at the top and then a Democrat as VP on their ticket. This is a moderate group who just says that most of the country does not want Biden or Trump. And so this is going to be an alternative. But I think no matter who gets elected in the fall, if it is Biden or Trump, and look, even if I support an independent candidate, it's a tough road in the U.S. for an independent to win. If Biden or Trump wins, I think there's a lot of issues going to follow. The first one's going to be, I'm afraid that whichever side loses is going to claim that there's some illegitimacy in the election. So unfortunately, we're at a bad place right now, I think, in American politics. And I think the blame largely falls down to what has happened to the two political parties. I've argued that the parties have become dogmatic pseudo-religious identities now that are really motivated by hatred for the other side. And that's a really bad place to be.
And you, and we'll talk about this throughout our conversation. You served in the House of Representatives for 16 years, 2005 to 2021. So you're speaking from personal experience and personal knowledge. You also have the claim to fame as a former elected representative of also being a card-carrying political science, a PhD in the discipline. So looking back at your time in office, contrasting where we are now, 2024, when you first got to Capitol Hill and started walking the corridors in 2005, what's changed and why?
Well, when I first got to Washington in 2005, you know, there was a lot of partisanship, a level of bitterness between the two parties, but there are still things that both parties worked together on to get done. There was still a sense of, okay, we have a lot of disagreements between our two parties, but what can we work on together to accomplish for the American people? And I think that really began to change on the Republican side significantly after the election of President Obama in 2008. And it became, we on the Republican side, we just need to defeat the Democrats. And we cannot even, this whole idea that, well, the other side is evil, there's no negotiation with evil, we just have to say no. Now, that wasn't everybody, but that really began in earnest, I think, in 2009 amongst Republicans and grew stronger and stronger. And there were fewer Republicans who actually wanted to work together with Democrats to get something done for the country. And when Donald Trump was elected in 2016, I think Democrats very quickly took the same mindset that the Republicans are evil, Donald Trump is evil, we just need to do everything we can to defeat him, and you can't negotiate with evil. You can't sit down, you can't have debate, deliberation, compromise, which is the political process which is necessary in a democracy, especially the American democracy, that was set up to try to force, you know, with two branches of Congress and the president, you know, sharing powers, checks and balances. It was really, the Constitution was written to force conciliation, to try to force conciliation, because the framers of the Constitution knew that that was the way that you avoid tyranny by splitting the power up, but you also build patriotism, build a love for America and its institutions and its laws by giving everyone an opportunity to have their say. Law will get made when there is broad consensus. And we're not doing that right now. And that's one of the reasons that's making things worse. It has made things worse. Once the parties have taken on this position, it is a sectarian battle between the two. And that's not good for the country. Government can't operate that way. And I don't think the country can survive long term if that does not change.
So may I ask, and this is where I'd like to bring in some of the, if I could just put it this way, some of the Jesus stuff or some of the Christian churchy stuff into the conversation. In terms of putting our finger on what's changed and the why, I mean, it's very apropos that you talk about the responsibility of legislatures and also citizens to inculcate a love of country and to practice a love of country. Do you think in terms of what's shifting in the American political culture that it's not that partisanship is new. Partisanship has been around and inherent in the system for decades, if not since the inception. But it's the flavor of the partisanship and how it's flavored with perhaps a diminished capacity on the part of the population to be able to love or to be able to love properly or to practice well-ordered love. Do you think that's an element? Do you think that's a dynamic at play? Is there something kind of deeper on a moral or a spiritual or a cultural level that is related to the population's capacity to love and how that's getting manifested in our politics?
Well, I tend to believe that it is a lack of religious faith. People are looking for something else, and that something else has become politics, and it's become the political parties. And you know, I had a former colleague of mine say to me, he told me he was a evangelical Protestant, but then he became so disgusted by what was happening in some evangelical churches, and he decided to start calling himself a non-denominational Christian. He said the problem that he saw was there are evangelicals who think Trump is Jesus. It's that idol worship. The Republicans have Donald Trump, but Democrats also, it's the party has become an idol. And I think part of that is a diminishment of any type of religious faith amongst some Americans, or even if it has not gone away, it's been diminished. The religious faith, and people have put politics above it and put their party above their God, their faith.
So my follow-up question is, what do we do with that? I mean, how do we reclaim that capacity? How do we rebuild it? How do we engage in renewal and try to bring back morality and the proper capacity to engage and well-ordered love? I mean, how do we go about doing that? And the corollary question is, what role is there for Christians and Catholics and church teaching in that mix?
Well, I can go on for hours about that, obviously. But first, very, very quickly, let me say, I understand. I grew up in a different time. All right. I was born in 1966. I grew up in the 70s and 80s. At that time, I had a very strong patriotism, but that was very much supported by my Catholic faith because it was the time of Pope John Paul II and Ronald Reagan and the battle against the evil empire. And at that time, I saw the Catholic Church supporting everything that was good about American patriotism and good about America, freedom and democracy. I understand today things are different, but I still think the Catholic Church supports those best ideals of America. What I tend to see happening right now is, of course, we're going to get into the integralists, and I listened to the two podcasts that you did. I think both of the pro and con on that, I don't have major disagreements with, but the person, I'm forgetting who it was that you had on who was in favor of it, it was really not so much of a political integralism, or that it wasn't the church taking over the state, having control over the state. What I see happening right now, I mean, there's different problems in different places. So let's first talk about the Catholics who, the Catholic integralists whom, it's very frustrating to me because about 90 to 95% of the way I'm with them. They want to have a American government that is more involved. They're not, they don't like the libertarianism that became part of the Republican Party. They want to see the government doing more to help people. So I'm with them on that. I'm very happy to see that. I would say, I'm a Democrat, and so I see a role for more of a role for government than a lot of Republicans do, although I'm not a big government person. However, I think that what is going on to a large extent is a frustration with where the culture is in America. And unfortunately, I think there is a sense that, well, this needs to be fixed somehow. let's have the government fix it. I mean, and that is my, and I know that that's very, that doesn't cover all Catholic integralists. In a lot of them, I have a lot of respect for what they're saying and agree with them to a large extent, but we cannot expect the government to fix our culture. I think what it is it's being lazy. It is saying, it is, you know, as I believe, I think that our culture has a lot of problems. I'm very concerned about American culture, Western culture in general. But the way to change that is through evangelization. And it's our role as Catholics to evangelize the culture, not expect the government to do that. We should be weighing in, and I certainly, and I got, you know, that's why I'm not in Congress anymore. I lost the Democratic primary because, you know, the biggest issue was the fact that I was pro-life. But there are other issues on, you know, family issues that, you know, I just would not go along with the Democratic Party on those. Right. And I think those are things that are supported by my Catholic faith, but they're more than that. They're not just Catholic beliefs. I think they are true and come from natural law. But we need to evangelize the culture, not expect the government to do it. And I think that's what we as Catholics should be doing. Look, we take our faith into the public square. We should not be ashamed of that. But don't expect the government to fix things. It's a very dangerous game to say liberal democracy is somehow rotten, that the America was founded on these liberal democratic principles, and it was going to inevitably lead to where the culture is today. That's, you know, that I don't understand what the, I don't buy that. What I believe happened is we have failed. We as Catholic Christians have failed to evangelize the culture, and we need to do that today. It's going to be a long process. We want to see things get done quickly, but that's what we need to do.
I think this is a great point to bring in some of the themes. You wrote an article for First Things, I think it was a year or two ago, headlined Being Catholic First. And it was one part of reflection on your own terms of service in the House of Representatives, but another part, a call to action, if you will, for Catholics in America who are trying to sort out these challenges and come up with solutions and navigate a way forward. But really, I mean, the headline of that article kind of says it all. If we're looking for guidance, we need look no further than the commandment, the slogan, the mantra of being Catholic first. And we may not see the fruit of all that action in our lifetimes or in the near term, but that's the pathway, that's the only pathway that in which we can be confident. Can you speak to those themes in a little bit more detail?
Well, you know, it's difficult. I was in Congress for 16 years, and there's always things that you need to exercise prudence and know what to push in when, what to support and win. But you can never let go of your what you really know to be true. On abortion, you know, people would say that you know, I was a radical on abortion because I said, look, I believe life begins conception. It should be protected under law. The only exception that I would, you know, would see is for the life of the mother. However, I never, ever, I never voted for, I never co-sponsored a bill that was fewer than, I believe, 20 weeks, you know, to, you know, make abortion illegal after 20 weeks. And it had the exceptions for rape and incest in addition to life of the mother, because I knew it was not prudent to be pushing anything more than that. Now, I think that that wasn't an excuse to just say, well, we, you know, as some Catholics do, well, we're never going to get anything done. We shouldn't do anything. So I just think it's so easy to go either way, to go and say, well, all or nothing, or to just say, well, I'm going to give up my beliefs because, you know, it's not convenient for me. It's going to hurt me politically. You know, I certainly saw so many people do that. I don't know what's in their hearts, but it certainly looked like, you know, when things got tough, and we saw this after Roe v. Wade was overturned. I always warned, you know, pro-life groups that if Roe v. Wade is ever overturned, you're going to find out who these politicians really are, what they really believe. Are they still going to be out there and be supporting a pro-life position, or are they not? And unfortunately, we saw many who have backed away from that. We need to always put God first, put our Catholic faith first. And again, like I said, you need to be prudent. But you need to ask yourself every day, as I did, you know, what am I doing? Why am I doing it? And look, I have no regrets whatsoever for what I did. I have, you know, I wanted to stay in Congress. I never worked so hard on anything in those last two tough campaigns that I had. But look, it meant a whole lot more to me to stay true to what I know is the truth that I've been taught largely through my Catholic faith, but understanding natural law. And so I can look at myself in the mirror every day and be proud of what I did. And we all need to do that. And it's not easy. And sometimes you need to make compromises, but you can't let that be something that you stop thinking about every day and praying about every day.
You spent 16 years in Congress. I'm sure going into that and going into your first term, lots of enthusiasm, excitement about how you can make a difference, where you can help affect positive change. And yet in this conversation here, talking about how Catholics can make sense of the current moment, what we should do, where we should invest our energies, a lot of it goes to practice the faith first and foremost and evangelize the culture. And the flip side of that is a recognition that there are limitations to what we can achieve in the political arena. How do you reflect on that limitation on what we can achieve through our politics versus what we can achieve through influencing culture? How do you reflect on that now versus how you may have approached that theme prior to your service in Congress?
Well, I think that I always understood that, you know, I didn't, let me take a step back here. I didn't go into politics. I didn't go in to be the pro-life guy. That was not the issue that I would talk about when I was campaigning. Now, whenever the issue came up, I would take a firm stand on it, but that's not why I went into politics. That's not why I ran for Congress. There's a lot of other things that I talked about that I spent 99.9% of my time on, because there's a lot of things that government can do to be helpful to people and create a good environment of freedom and help, you know, give people the opportunity to succeed. Now, I think that the culture, you know, is in a much worse place than it was 20 years ago when I entered politics. There are things that have gone into law that I fought against, and I am happy and proud that I did. Right now, I mean, obviously the abortion issue, especially since Roe was overturned, has been an issue that you know, especially as a Democrat. I mean, it bothers me greatly that Democrats have now, they now see this as a winning issue. They're all talking about it, no matter what they're running for. And that's, you know, it didn't used to be that way. Even 10 years ago, it wasn't that way. And so I think that I don't know if my views of what government can do have changed. I think I've always understood the limited role of government. I just think so much because the culture has taken a turn for the worse in the last 20 years. I understand how much more important it is to evangelize the culture than I ever thought before.
Mm-hmm. May I ask, I want to get clarification. I think I've heard you say a couple of times, you're still a registered Democrat, correct?
Well, we don't register by party in Illinois. So,
okay.
Yes, I still consider myself a Democrat. Part of the reason is if I said that I was no longer a Democrat, people assume I'm a Republican. I don't want to be a Republican either right now. So, but, you know, I go into the voting booth and I vote for whoever I think the best candidate is. But do I still consider myself a Democrat? Yes. And I tried for years, and it's you know, looking tougher and tougher to change the Democratic Party. That's where I'm at.
And I'm sure you can see where I'm going with this next question. I suspect many listeners are saying, and I fully anticipate you get this question all the time, but based on your experience in Congress, based on the seriousness with which you approach your faith, I mean, how do you still thread that needle of being, aspiring to be a devout, serious Catholic and maintaining party affiliation with the Democrats? I'm sure many people are just scratching their head and just saying, like, how the heck do you actually do that? That just explain that to me.
Well, you know, people would come up to me many, many, many times over the years and say, well, you can't be, a lot of times they talk about being pro-life, can't be pro-life and be a Democrat. And I'd always say, well, if being a Democrat prevented me from voting in speaking the way that I believe, then I wouldn't be a Democrat anymore. But it doesn't. Being a member of a party, getting back to what I said at the beginning, it's become an identity for so many people. Political parties are not supposed to be identity. It's supposed to be organizing entities. So I don't have a problem with that. I'm not asking anybody. Like I said, I don't think I'm going to be supporting Joe Biden. I'm pretty certain I'm not for president this year. I'm certainly not going to ask anyone to vote for him or for other Democrats. So I don't see any. It's the way I look at parties. I took a lot of heat from my Democratic colleagues that I wasn't out there enough, you know, promoting Democrats. The party was just a vehicle for me. It wasn't my be all and end all and doing everything for the party. I was working for my constituents in the country.
Mm. May I ask, if there was a young person in your circle of acquaintance, or perhaps students, I mean, you've returned to the classroom, visiting fellow at Stanford and visiting fellow at the University of Dallas as well. I mean, in your interactions with students, perhaps you have some who are going through this exact struggle. Their political inclinations orient them towards the Democratic Party for various reasons, but they take their faith seriously. How do you handle that? Would you actively discourage a student from pursuing membership or participation in the Democratic Party if they were a serious Catholic, or what kind of counsel would you give to them?
Well, I mean, it happens many times. It's happened many times over the years. Students who come up to me and say, a lot of times they're like, I'm pro-life. I agree with the Democrats on a lot of other issues. And I just basically, you know, I'm not going to tell them what to do. It's very hard these days if you being pro-life in the Democratic Party. I still want to see the party change. It's in the last couple of years, it has gotten to a point where I'm not sure how it's going to change to be more accepting of people who are pro-life. I basically lay it out for anyone, any young person who asks me what I see and what their choices are, and you know they have to make that decision about what they're going to do, what they're going to consider themselves. And again, I go back to, you know, when you're voting, vote for the candidate you want to support. If you want to get involved in politics, it is so tough today on either side. I'm a very independent thinker, right? And Catholics don't fit comfortably in either party. So, you know, if I were choosing a party today, it would be really hard. Because I would always, you know, I'd always say, I'm not going to agree with either party on everything. And so people have to accept that. But unfortunately, it's not accepted by so many people today. And that has to change. I mean, that's just very damaging. And I said, the country's not going to be able to survive that way if we don't understand that, you know, we need to learn how to live with each other, and we need to be willing to make compromises. And the political parties don't operate like that today.
May I ask what first drew you to the Democratic Party?
I'm from Chicago. There's no choice. because I mean, there's some truth to that. Like my father was in politics before me. Mm-hmm. Growing up in Chicago, we had Democrats who were pretty far to the left, you know, say back in the 80s, pretty far to the left, which is not as far left as people have gone today in the party. But we also people pretty conservative in the party. Everyone was a Democrat. There's still Democrats who are like that. I always saw the Democratic Party as a party that's for the little guy. Mm-hmm. And that's basically the reason why. I think government has a role to play, an important role to play. Again, I find myself somewhat in the middle here, but I'm definitely not a libertarian. So that's basically why have been supportive of the Democratic Party. Now, there are a few issues that the Republicans have moved on, which I'm happy they've moved on, issues such as trade. I think that's important. Being more supportive of working men and women. I think some people in the Republican Party have moved in that direction, understanding that there is a role for government to play in helping people, creating an environment where people can succeed and flourish. And I'm happy to see the Republican Party move in that direction. You know, maybe someday it'll be a party that I find that I'm very comfortable in. It's not today, but that's why I became a Democrat all those years ago.
And was there a role, or in terms of the Democratic Party's history, as you say, protecting the little guy and how that extended or applied to minority Catholic populations in the United States, and how you had that kind of traditional alliance between Catholic communities and the Democrats because that was the only home for them politically?
Yeah, well, I think it that's why it was a home for Catholics, the Democratic Party, because they were for the little guy. They were also more accepting of immigrants as they came over. Mm-hmm. And so that was the tradition, although I understand my father's father was a Republican, so he didn't. His parents were Polish immigrants, but it wasn't every Catholic who was a Democrat. But yeah, it was just the party that was much more accepting of Catholics and of immigrants.
As you reflect, as we're talking here about participation from Catholics in either political party, when you look back on your time in Congress and the interaction among Catholic elected representatives from either side of the aisle, from either chamber, What jumps out to you in terms of vivid memories? Was there a sense of fraternity and camaraderie amongst Catholics on Capitol Hill, or was it not as rosy as that?
It was a very significant split between Democrats and Republicans. I found myself, I oftentimes found myself with Republican Catholics, because Republican Catholics were more, I believe, in many ways true to the faith on, you know, on some of the important issues, such as abortion, obviously, and family. Back in 2005, my first year in Congress, I was privileged to be part of a delegation for the installation mass for Pope Benedict. Mm-hmm. So Democrats, Republicans, even number each side, go over there to, you know, represent Congress, and we're there, and I'm told there's going to be a meeting with Cardinal Francis George of Chicago. And I was like, oh, that's great. We met with him. He was talking about, you know, his experience of the papal conclave. And I'm sitting in the room, and I realize, I look around, and I said, I'm the only Democrat in this room. What happened? None of the other, you know, Democrats bothered to show up for this meeting. And that early on was when my first indication of there's a real split here. Of, you know, Democrats and Republicans, even who are Catholics. And there was talk about starting a Catholic caucus. There are more than 200 caucuses, maybe more than that. I mean, they're groups. Most of them don't do a whole lot except represent an interest. Some of them actually are involved in helping policymaking. But it's a way for House members to claim membership in a group for a reason. There's talk about doing a Catholic caucus, and the decision was made that we shouldn't do that, because which kind of Catholics is this going to be? Mm. We'd have meetings at the pastor at St. Peter's on Capitol Hill on the House side, who's now bishop up in Bill Byrne. He's up in Massachusetts. So he invited members over for dinner once a month. And, you know, it was mostly Republicans and me. And we have a harder time getting Catholic Democrats to show up. There's a real split there. And it was terrible. And the worst time was the Affordable Care Act. The use of that by those who wanted to pass it, the Obama administration, Democrats who wanted to pass it, I voted against it. But the using that split amongst Catholics was one of the worst times when I was in Congress. You had the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops opposing the bill because of the funding for abortion. You had the Catholic Health Association supporting it. So you had some congregations of sisters supporting it. And that was just really awful to see that split in the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. And I think that was exploited. And it certainly was used, you know, it was argued to me that, oh, look, these Catholics, when I'd say I'm not voting for a bill that provides public funding for abortion, I'd be, oh, look, there's these Catholics who don't agree with that. Don't believe that. So that was tough. So there's a real split. The split, you know, between Americans and political parties runs through the Catholic Church also, which I think is, it's been that way for a while. Again, you can be it doesn't necessarily mean you're a sectarian partisan if you are a member of, you know, you say you're a Democrat or a Republican, but it's become much more so that way, even in the a church, people putting their party up on a pedestal, I think oftentimes higher than their Catholic faith.
May I ask, and rest assured, I'm not looking to just throw shade or cast shade on anyone and play gotcha or point fingers, but I'm curious to hear your take on this. I'll admit, I have been amongst those Catholics who has caught himself at times thinking, well, if only the bishops were more aggressive or more forceful or more vocal on these issues or cracking the whip on elected officials who are obstinately out of line with Catholic teaching. I mean, what's your take on that? I mean, kind of general reflections on how you observed the bishops engaging in political and public life. Were there things you would have wanted the bishops and the bishops' conference to do differently? Are there things that perhaps the average layperson doesn't know that you think is important in terms of affirming the value that the bishops brought to that process, maybe that we don't see or we don't fully appreciate? Your take on that?
Well, I think that the Catholic bishops have, you know, much less power than they've had. I'm trying to think. Since there have been that many Catholics who are in public life, Catholic bishops have never had as little power as they have. I think there are, you know, bishops vary in terms of what they are, you know, how they interact with members of Congress, other elected officials. There are different ways of thinking about how to do it. I think it frustrates me at times where some bishops are not willing to, you know, use that the influence that they have in some areas. The areas that they choose to be vocal about. When it comes to policy, I sometimes question, but I hate to ever really question bishops in what they are doing. It's very dangerous to do that. I'll leave it at, yeah, I think there are some bishops who I think could do more on some issues than they are doing. I think you never know what's going on behind the scenes pastorally. Questions about, obviously the issues have come up about, you know, elected officials receiving, able to receive the Eucharist. And I don't want to really make any comments on that, except to say I think it's important for the bishops to emphasize that what your state must be in order to receive the Eucharist. And I think all Catholics need to better learn that and better understand that, hopefully with the hopefully now with the Eucharistic Congress and everything that's been going on, although I'm not sure I've seen it. I'm not sure most Catholics are really even aware of it, but that's something for all Catholics. I wrote a piece about that a couple years ago, and I think it's good for all Catholics, not just politicians, to better understand that.
May I ask, when you were elected to the U.S. House, how did that change your own relationship with your local priest or perhaps your local bishop? Did you kind of find yourself in a situation where, I mean, presumably you become a member of Congress. I mean, more people are willing to take your phone calls. Did you find yourself kind of thrust into a new relationship with your parish priest or your bishop and other members of the clergy or the hierarchy in the U.S.? How did that kind of affect your own need for pastoral guidance and spiritual direction? Or did it not change all that much? And if it didn't, you know, what kept you grounded in that regard?
Well, a couple of stories I'll tell you. One, the immigration issue was always the hottest topic in my most controversial issue in my district, not just in, under Donald Trump, before the moment I took office in 2005, is a district that had a significant Hispanic population, also a good number of people who were very much opposed to any sort of immigration reform, anti-immigrant. And so that was a hot issue in the district. And I oftentimes had priests who would come to my town hall meetings and, publicly, come with pro-reform groups. And my position when I first started was against, any comprehensive immigration reform. I said we need to first, secure the border and make other changes. I changed that during my time in office. I realized that comprehensive immigration reform, if it's ever going to happen, it has to be most likely going to have to be comprehensive. So I'd have priests come and be very, very strong and very public. One time a priest who came and I thought used a child very inappropriately in the town hall meeting. And afterwards, I told him privately that I thought it was inappropriate what he had done to that child. And he apologized almost, for that.
Almost using the child as a prop, perhaps?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I also had a bishop who, called me, asked to meet with me. He wanted to talk to me about immigration reform. And we had a very good meeting and talked about it. Very different than, he's sort of generally the same position as a priest who did it very publicly, but he did it privately. And we had a good conversation about it. Mm. And I always have used that as an example of, I think that's the appropriate way that these issues should be handled by priests. And it probably had a bigger impact, perhaps, on me. The other thing, the other story is, so the entire time, I guess not the entire time, most of the time that I was in Congress, Cardinal Francis George was my bishop. He did not like talking to politicians. He didn't want to get involved with politicians because he didn't want to be used by politicians. And he was president of USCCB when the Affordable Care Act was being considered. And I still have the message on my voicemail on my phone from Cardinal George the day after I voted against it, thanking me for doing that.
Wow.
After the Affordable Care Act, he became very much, he changed the way that he dealt with politicians. He learned that he needed to deal with them. Because it was important. It was important to have those relationships. And I thought that was very interesting. Someone said that to me, and it was very clear to me that he did then change in the way he saw it. He understood the importance of that. I remember at sometime a couple months after the Affordable Care Act vote, and at some event, the Chicago Archdiocese may have been a pro-life event where he actually praised me from while he was speaking, and people came up to me afterwards and said, "You don't know how unusual that is for the cardinal to even talk about a politician." And I was greatly honored by that, but I also understood that he had come to learn that you need to deal with politicians. Be careful about being used, and I completely understand that sense of not wanting to be used by politicians. And I think clergy have to be careful about that, but they also need to be in contact with them. So, I've had a lot of experience because I was always open to any time a priest wanted to talk to me about anything, policy wise, about my job, about anything. I was always. He's a priest. I need to talk to him. It's my responsibility to speak with him.
Mm-hmm. Just as we hit the home stretch of our conversation here, a couple of questions. I want to go back. In the beginning, I mentioned this is a unique moment in the calendar for 2024, Super Tuesday tomorrow. But the State of the Union is scheduled for later this week. And I can't help but ask, I can't resist. I mean, you were in Congress for 16 years. You sat through 16 States of the Union. When you hear the words State of the Union, just how do you react in your gut? Does it bring you up? Does it lift you up? Or does it kind of take the breath out of your lungs?
Well, first thing I think about, and it's not how you meant it. I thought at first you were talking about it, is being actually at the speech. I hated that speech so much. I think they should stop doing them because I despise having to stand up and sit down and look around, especially because I was always have to be a little bit more careful about when I, you know, there are times where I'd stand up with Republicans and I'm like, okay, I can do that. Because everyone's looking around to see who's standing it, and, you know, can I stand or not on this? I hated the State of the Union address. I hated having to go to that. The State of the Union, I am, well, let me say, first of all, I'm a pessimist. So that's naturally the way that, that I am. Although I've in Yuval Levin's new book, he's probably said it elsewhere. I know you just had Yuval on, on podcast, and he said optimism and pessimism are dangerous vices. Hope is a virtue. And so I'm someone who has hope. But I'm also expecting to be disappointed. So I think that America's in a really bad spot right now. And I'm trying to figure out how America is going to get through this. I think the culture is the biggest issue that we have a problem with, but also our politics are a major problem. I don't need to be optimistic to spend most of my waking hours thinking about this. Well, maybe not that much. A lot of my time thinking about this issue and this problem in working to make things better. So I'm just going to keep doing that. And I'm always, when people look to me to be optimistic, I always say, you know, Mother Teresa, St. Mother Teresa, Calcutta, I just watched her address to the 1994 National Prayer Breakfast, which was quite astounding. I recommend it for everybody to go back and watch that. But Mother Teresa is reported to have said, "We are called not to be successful, but to be faithful." Mm-hmm. And that is what motivates me every day. So I think the State of the Union is not good. The economy is good, which it's not what we are, you know, that's not what's most important, but it helps. It should help. Other things to be better, our politics to be better and our culture to be better. So at least the economy right now is on good footing. The culture needs a lot of evangelization, and so does our politics. Our politics needs to change, and we need to have politicians who have a, you know, really a new plan, a different plan than is out there, in a plan looking forward and looking to what we can do together rather than just attacking the other side. And that's what we need, and that's what I keep working for.
Just in our remaining minutes, I wanted to talk a little bit about Leo XIII, one of your positions that you hold now is the Pope Leo XIII Fellow on Social Thought at the University of Dallas. More and more, as I've read his work, I've become increasingly intrigued by Leo XIII. I mean, just how the enormous influence he had on the church in his day and in the century afterwards. But a couple of things always jump out to me with Louis XIII. One, I mean, he did seem to kind of cast a little bit of a skeptical eye across the pond towards the church in the United States. And I mean, he had that famous letter, I think, to the Cardinal of Baltimore saying, yeah, you know, the church in America is doing really well, but you know, don't think that you have a secret sauce or there's some kind of magic formula which is unique to you guys. You know, you need to be part of the universal body, and so don't think you're all that exceptional. That's one piece that I've always found intriguing from him. And another piece is his encyclical on Christians as citizens. And I know some people in my own little enclave and circle of acquaintance, we read that quite a bit during the recent years of the pandemic when we were trying to make sense of all these restrictions, particularly up here in Canada, which seemed to be grossly overreaching. And there are passages in Leo's encyclical on Christians as citizens, essentially laying out the criteria where civil disobedience is justified. So those have always been two works by him that have always intrigued me. I'm just wondering, you know, you are the Pope Leo the 13th Fellow on Social Thought. Do you meditate more on his works, and how does occupying a position named in his honor, have you found a new appreciation or kind of rediscovered anything from his teaching? And is there anything unique that he might have to offer the church at this time?
Well, you probably know more about Leo XIII than I do. I hate to admit that, but
you flatter me. I'm not sure that's true, but you flatter me.
A couple things here. One, my big focus on Leo XIII has always been Rerum Novarum, which I think is, you know. I have an award here, which if people can see this, I know they can't. I know you can see part of it up there, Rerum Novarum Award, because of my work, especially for the church and especially for working people. I think that was critically important, and it was. I think we should all go back and look at that again with challenges right now to capitalism and to understand what, as Catholics, what our, how we should view capitalism and maybe what our responsibilities are and should be in that. I think that there's still a lot of questions about what does Americanism mean? Americanism as a heresy. And I think different people use that in a different way these days in terms of what that means. Let me go in this direction right now, which is sort of related, but not exactly where you're going. But it bothers me that I talk about the culture in America. I think the Catholic culture is really not generally in a good place, but we have Catholic apostolates that are just incredible in this country. We have young people who are on fire for their faith. When I was younger, I did not have that fire that they have. We have people, Catholics, who really are, ready to take on this role of evangelizing the culture here and around the world. I think we should be an example. I think America sometimes, unfortunately, Pope Francis, I think, doesn't understand America well. He has a lot of misconceptions about America and American Catholics. And I think there's a lot of very good things going on in the Catholic Church amongst Catholics in this country. And so I'm very hopeful about that. And part of that, I think, comes from being, we are Americans and we are more, entrepreneurial and entrepreneurial in, rediscovering our faith in learning how to be entrepreneurial in evangelization. And I think that's really important. And anyone who really wants to be, the opportunities to get in touch and to learn more about our Catholic faith today are greater than they've ever been. And so I think that is absolutely wonderful. As Catholics, we need to remember that, again, we need to be Catholic first. And, you know, there's things about America, Americans who are very, there's a self-centeredness. There's this idea that what's important is economics and economic prosperity, and that is not what's most important. There's this idea that we all know what's right, and we're not going to let anyone tell us what to do. And as I've always said, I'm an independent thinker. I question everything. And as a Catholic, that's especially tough to be someone who questions everything. But I'm comfortable saying that if I don't understand something that the Catholic Church is teaching me, it's my responsibility to try to understand and to bring my mind into understanding and believing. And I can accept that as, you know, I have debates with others on this issue. That's a very un-American idea, I think. But that's something that as Catholics, that I think that's what our faith calls us to do.
Here, here. In my more mischievous moments, I sometimes think if Pope Leo came back to America in 2024 and looked at the state of the church, you know, there would be a lot there that would make him smile, and there would be a lot, there'd be grounds for Catholics in America to say, Pope Leo, look at us now, give us another look. I'm going to conclude our conversation just with a very quick quotation from Pope Leo the 13th encyclical on Christians as citizens. I think it's very apropos. Quote, "No better citizen is there, whether in time of peace or war, than the Christian who is mindful of his duty. But such a one should be ready to suffer all things, even death itself, rather than abandon the cause of God or of the church." End quote. Congressman Lipinski, I want to thank you so much for your time today. And thank you for being a model of what Pope Leo was talking about in terms of faithful citizenship and obligations and fulfilling the duty and being prepared to sacrifice many things, including one's political livelihood, for the cause of God and his church. So thank you very much for that. And thank you so much for your time today. It's been a real treat.
It's been great to be with you.
Thanks so much for tuning in. If you're enjoying Crown and Crozier, don't forget to subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts. And we'd be grateful if you could help us reach more listeners by leaving us a rating or referring us to a friend. Also, we'd love to hear from you. Check out our website at crownandcrozier.com. Or drop us a line on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. We're sincerely grateful for your support, and we look forward to providing you with future episodes on church, state, and faithful citizenship.